Have you ever experienced a time when things seemed utterly hopeless? Circumstances were so difficult that you couldn't really see how God could allow them. There's no way anything good could come from it. Well, the truth is, most of us, to some degree or another, have experienced a time similar to this in our lives. Now, 2 weeks ago, we left a young woman in a potentially very similar situation. For those of you who are visiting, we are studying the book of Esther, and we are in chapter 2, verses 9 through 23. And just as a quick review, King Ahasuerus, try saying that three times fast, or Xerxes in the Greek. This king, with the help of his wise counselors, they come up with a plan to replace Queen Vashti. The king sends out officers throughout the land to gather beautiful women. From these women, the king will choose a new queen. Esther was one of the women who was chosen. She was a Jew living in Susa, where the capital was at that time. And she was living with her older cousin Mordecai. Now, the text really does not describe Esther's reaction. However, she was most likely shocked by the situation she suddenly found herself in. While she was a Jew living in exile there in the land, she was free. She was not a slave. Her parents were dead, but her cousin Mordecai had adopted her and taken on the role of father. So, with this, Esther lost her freedom, her family, and potentially her hope for the future in one fell swoop. The title of today's sermon is Esther's Ascent, and in less than one chapter, we're going to see Esther go from an exile to queen. And here's this morning's outline. Part one, standing out while blending in. Part two, Esther crowned queen. And part three, Mordecai exposes a plot. And this morning we're going to be reading from the ESV. However, at times I'm going to be referring to the New Living Translation as well as the New King James Bible. Rather than read the entire passage now, we will read each section as we come to each part. So part one is titled Standing Out While Blending In. And Esther, the reason why it's called that is Esther demonstrates the ability to stand out amongst her peers while at the same time blend in by verbally not even sharing her faith. So with that, we will go ahead and read part one. Let me see here. There we go. And the young woman pleased him, and him would have been Haggai, and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go to the king, Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil and myrrh, and 6 months with spices and ointments for women. When the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of Shahaskaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. All right. Now, in verse 7, in the previous passage that we looked at last time, it tells us that Esther had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. But in verse 9, you begin to wonder if there's a little bit more going for Esther than just her physical appearance. In verse 9, the New Living Translation says, Haggai was very impressed with Esther and treated her kindly. He quickly ordered a special menu for her and provided her with beauty treatments. He also assigned her 7 maids, specially chosen from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Okay. Excuse me. Finding my spot here. Okay, there we go. Now, if you're wondering what the best place in the harem was, as I did, the New King James Version uses the phrase, the best place in the house of the women. And so it seems that the best place has more of a literal meaning than a figurative meaning. Maybe it had 2 windows instead of 1. I don't know. So Haggai gives Esther a special menu, 7 handmaids, and the best place in the harem. We don't know exactly how Esther's peers were treated, but it seems that Esther was treated differently. How come? Was it just her physical beauty? Ah, there we go. Verse 10 and 11 tell us that Esther did not tell anyone that she was a Jew or shared her family background. She was obedient to Mordecai. Now, despite the fact that Haggai gave her a special menu, there's no reason to believe that it was a kosher diet. So one consequence of not sharing her heritage is that she broke the dietary laws that God had instructed for his people. Now, why would Mordecai give her this directive? Perhaps he thought that her nationality would be held against her and she would be mistreated. As we see in the next chapter, there is a movement against the Jewish people beginning to take place in that area. But ultimately, the text does not tell us why Mordecai gave Esther this directive. In verse 11, Mordecai shows concern for Esther. He's checking in on her daily, walking near the court where she was. Again, if you think about it, he probably would have needed to be very subtle about this, though, or maybe he received his information through a third party, because had he been communicating with Esther daily, which might not have even been possible, and asking frequent questions about Esther, how's she doing, others probably would have quickly picked up that there was a connection, and this is what Mordecai was trying to avoid in the first place. So, verse 12 describes the year-long process that Esther and her peers had to go through before they were considered ready to meet with the king. Now, we don't know how many others really were in Esther's position. Skip told us that the Jewish historian Josephus estimated that maybe there were 400. And the beautification process took 12 months. Why so long? Why would it take that long? Well, it could be that one of the reasons for this long would be that it was a way of kind of figuring out if anybody was pregnant. Matthew Poole, I thought this was an interesting quote, take it as it is. Matthew Poole in his commentary states, the bodies of men and women in those hot countries did of themselves yield very ill sense. Ill sense. If not corrected by qualified art. I like that, that qualified art. So what they were doing was qualified art. The word regulations in verse 12 implies that this was a formal process, possibly an edict or actually a law. Now, verse 13 and 14 give the specific details about meeting with the king. When the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in the custody of Shahaskaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would go in to the king again, unless the king delighted in her and was summoned by name. Now, those two verses, especially verse 14, really bring out the grim nature of these circumstances. For each woman, there was one night. Now, the Hebrew euphemisms are really very clear as to what took place during this evening. The next morning, she's taken off to a different harem, probably made up of women who have gone through the same experience. She's now a concubine. She will live, most likely, for the rest of her life in the king's palace. She's not free to go see her family or her loved ones. She's not free to marry or bear children, unless it's for the king. Potentially a very, very lonely existence filled with little hope. Now, interestingly, the text doesn't really tell us about Esther losing hope. As we heard in our call to worship, she shows resilience. With that, let's move to part two, Esther crowned queen. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now, King Esther was winning the favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into the royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the province and gave gifts with royal generosity. So, if you're simply following the narrative here, verses 15 and 16 can seem redundant and easily looked over. However, there's some great information within those verses. Let's begin with the symbolism in verse 15. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter. There's an emphasis on Esther's family by repeating information previously mentioned in verse 5 through 7. Except for this time, Abihail, the name of Esther's father, is mentioned for the very first time. Why is the text telling us this right now? Well, when a woman went to visit the king, what took place was not a mystery. The commentator David G. Firth points out that there are some things King Ahasuerus can take from Esther. However, by emphasizing Esther's family, specifically her father's name. This may be pointing out that the king can't take away her family, her Jewish heritage, or her faith in God. Can't take that away. Do you ever think about what God has given you that the world can't take away? Hopefully that can put things in perspective for all of us. In verse 16, there is a carefully documented historical timeline. Esther was taken to the king in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now, by being precise with the date, it feels like the author knows he is chronicling something so significant that it's going to be looked back upon with tremendous, the word is significant, but I used that in the sentence before, with tremendous significance. Now, this was 4 years after Vashti had been removed as queen. Why take so long for a new one? Well, the beauty rituals, that would have taken at least 1 year. Also, as Skip said previously, the Greek historian Herodotus, who died in 425 BC, notes that during this time period, King Ahasuerus was likely busy losing wars to the Greek Empire. And this would have probably taken place between chapter 1 and chapter 2. So the narrative continues in verse 17. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Esther has gone from an unknown Jewish girl living in exile to the queen of the most powerful nation in the world. What got her there? Well, the simplest answer would be God's providence. And that answer is absolutely correct. Well, it's sort of like when Brianna and Andy met for the very first time. She sat down and talked to him. She introduced herself. And you might say the rest is history. But it still took her initiating. And eventually I hear that Andy kind of, made things that made his intentions known that, hey, I'm serious about this relationship. I want to go deeper. And, those are just human circumstances, but it still took Brianna introducing herself and Andy getting the courage up to say, okay. So that's the same thing. Providence, God's providence exists, but there's still a human component too. So back to Esther. We know that she was beautiful, but does the text tell us anything more? The word favor is used 3 times in this passage to describe how others perceived her. Verse 9 says that she won favor with Haggai. Verse 15 says that she was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And I presume that would also include her peers, which says something. And in verse 17, Esther won grace and favor with the king. So does the word favor give us a clue to her success, if you will? Well, in verse 9 and 17, the Hebrew word for favor can be translated as hesed. And this can mean kindness, grace, and favor. It's often used as a word of God's feeling towards man, but in reality, it can be used human to human as well. The Hebrew word for favor in verse 15 is hen, which can mean agreeableness, charm, and favor. So frankly, when I was going through this, I wanted to know if the Hebrew words for favor had a physical element, something related to her outer beauty. But in reality, that doesn't seem to be the case. It appears that Esther's character was the major factor regarding her success, her ascent. Now, her looks really probably didn't work against her, but her character contributed tremendously to how she was perceived and ultimately treated. Her character even influenced the king. So, what can we learn from this? Well, character matters. People are watching us. Others make conclusions, positive and negatives, about what we're doing, how we act. Now, stepping back here, because of the cultural setting of this book, I can catch myself thinking that Esther is a great example for Christian women today. However, that's really only half true. Esther is a great example for both men and women today. Think about Proverbs 3:3-4. Let not steadfast love and faithfulness forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart, so you will find favor and good success in the sight of God and man. That's for all of us. Okay. Verse 18 describes a great feast that the king gave in honor of Queen Esther. And we don't know how long it was, but from the lack of detail, it was probably not quite as lengthy or opulent than we hear about the feast that took place 4 years previously. From the tone, it seems like the king is a bit more generous rather than simply flaunting his wealth, and his generosity leads to a remission of taxes throughout the Persian Empire. And this brings us to point three. Mordecai exposes a plot. I've been struggling with that word all week as I've been practicing. Exposes a plot. Okay. Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting by the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told it to the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So verse 19 begins with, now when the virgins were gathered together for a second time. And this phrase is a little curious because we don't really know, for a second time. And that phrase is curious because we don't really know when the first time was. Perhaps the first time refers to when the women initially arrived at the king's palace. And the second time is now potentially referring to all the virgins who never met with the king. It's possible they were allowed to leave the palace and return home, but that's really just speculation. The second part of verse 19 reads, Mordecai is sitting at the king's gate. Again, while we don't know for sure, it's possible that Mordecai has moved up in position since Esther has become queen. Previously, Mordecai did have some type of position in or around the king's palace, and we know that because of how often he was checking up on Esther. In verse 19, And again in verse 21, the phrase sitting at the king's gate is used when it wasn't used previously. So that's another reason to think maybe something's changed. So Esther continues to keep her Jewish heritage a secret. And while she is now the queen, it points out she is now obedient to, she remains obedient to Mordecai. She doesn't reveal her Jewish faith. However, her character has spoken volumes. Sharing our faith is important. And the Holy Spirit, hopefully we listen to the Holy Spirit for when the time is right. We had the phrase pointed out to us again, share the gospel, and when necessary, use words. I think Esther is a good example of that. In verse 21, Mordecai overhears two of the king's eunuchs plot to assassinate the king. And the New Living Translation describes these two as guards at the door of the king's private quarters. So they probably had pretty good access to the king. Mordecai reports the plot to Esther, who tells the king, but makes sure Mordecai gets the credit. The plot was investigated. Both eunuchs brought to justice. The NLT, New Living Translation, says they were impaled on a pole, which most commentators agree with. Now, verse 23 states that this was all recorded in the presence of the king, which could easily indicate that the king approved of it being recorded. Now, it just so happens, wink, wink, nod, nod, that Mordecai doesn't get any credit for this from the king. Nothing happens. So, on that note, chapter 2 somewhat quietly ends. But now, we know that the stage is set for a series of unbelievable events about ready to unfold. And next week, we will meet the chief antagonist, Haman. All right, coming down the home stretch. When I first discovered, be honest here, when I first discovered I would be speaking on this specific passage, I felt a little uncomfortable. Much of the subject matter is not what we'd call family-friendly. And frankly, some of the specific details in this passage are not beneficial to dwell on over and over again in our minds. But at the same time, we can see God's hand at work amidst this incredibly hedonistic environment. And there's also a fascinating contrast taking place. The passage begins with Ahasuerus seeking a bride. Well, we know that Christ is coming to seek a bride as well. Ahasuerus chooses maybe 400 women. Well, Christ died for everyone. The king's candidates, well, they were based on beauty. Christ looks only at our hearts. Ahasuerus required a year of beauty treatments. Well, Christ accepts us right now, just as we are. We, the church, are Christ's bride. Unlike people wondering about their faith, we know we've been chosen. Our eternal future is secure. We, whom the New Testament refers to as the saints, we know we are going to stand before God and be welcomed into his kingdom. We know Christ's sacrificial death has made this possible. So in conclusion, there's really two questions that need to be asked. One, are you certain of your eternal destiny? And if not, you know, try and reach out to someone. If you're confident, that the death of Christ has put you on a right standing with God, the question I hope to evoke in all of us is, what am I doing now to prepare for the coming of my groom, Christ? Andy and Brianna, well, their wedding was yesterday. As Christ's bride, we know that our wedding is going to take place. Maybe tomorrow, maybe in 5 years, maybe in 50 years, but we know it's going to happen. When times were very difficult, Esther stood out. She won the favor of others. How are you standing out? How are you demonstrating Christ's love to others? How do others around you know that you are preparing yourself for your groom?